To kick off the year, I'm starting a new series called The Legacy, Africa Through Their Eyes. This is a series that features past heads of states of African countries as they walk us through their personal lessons of leadership and how they defined their legacy.
As Africa's first democratically elected female head of state, Her Excellency Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, President of Liberia from 2006 to 2018, has many achievements under her belt, a lot of which precede her role as president and many more after that. During her presidency, she led Liberia through reconciliation and recovery following the nation's decade-long civil war, as well as the Ebola crisis, winning international acclaim for achieving economic, social, and political change. Never losing sight of principles of democracy, peace, and social and economic equity and development, President Sirleaf exemplifies visionary, steadfast leadership, service, and accomplishment at the highest level. Despite being jailed and exiled throughout her life, she's been a vocal and unstoppable critic of government abuse and corruption. Recognized as a global leader for women's empowerment, President Sirleaf was awarded the prestigious Nobel Prize for Peace in 2011. She's also the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the United States' highest civilian award, for her personal courage and unwavering commitment to expanding freedom and improving the lives of Africans. Her many honors also include the Grand Croix of the Légion d'Honneur, France's highest public distinction, and being named one of Forbes' 100 most powerful women in the world. And in 2017, President Sirleaf was awarded the Mo Ibrahim Prize for Achievement in African Leadership, which celebrates excellence in African leadership. The Ibrahim Prize recognizes leaders who, during their time in office, have developed their countries, strengthened democracy and human rights for the shared benefits of their people, and advanced sustainable development. Madam President, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was the first female recipient. Internationally known as Africa's Iron Lady, Nobel laureate Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is a leading promoter of freedom, peace, justice, women's empowerment, and democratic rule. In 2008, she published her critically acclaimed memoir, This Child Will Be Great, and it is a must read. And without further ado, let's get straight to the chat with President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. I am so excited. Yeah. So, Madam President, thank you for being here again. It's an honor to have some time with you today. To get us started, I thought it would be interesting to know a little bit about your experience or your time as president of Liberia. And what would you say is your fondest memory as president, looking back today?
Look, my time in president really was a follow-up to many years of activism, many years of international and domestic service. So all I did was to have the opportunity to put some of those experiences into action as president. So my journey was a very long one. What do I remember most of all? I remember the fact that I was able, coming after two decades of civil war, to bring peace to our country and to bring hope to the people of our country. And I'm glad to say that we now this year, 2023, are celebrating 20 consecutive years of peace. And I think that's my main legacy.
That's remarkable. And I think reflecting back on the time, you just mentioned that the journey didn't start from being president, right? It was years leading up to that. But I'm curious as well, do you remember what the experience was like when the announcement came through or when the call came through that you had won? What was that like for you at that time?
Oh, well, I was with many of my compatriots and many of my partisans in what we called our war room, where we sat to be able to manage the process, to be able to see the votes as they came in and all of that. So we were already prepared when the announcement came because we had monitored the vote all over the country, you know, through partisans that gave the volunteer their time to be able to do this. But of course, the official announcement, it took a while, but when the official announcement came, it was like, finally, all these years of work.
Yeah.
Now we have the opportunity to put all of our ideas into action.
Yeah. And I mean, you became president in Liberia, you know, at a time when it was emerging from a somewhat devastating past. And very quickly, we saw Liberia sort of rise and hit 7, 8, 9% GDP growth. What would you say in terms of, you know, putting these actions in place? What would you say were some of the key driving forces that helped to achieve such substantial levels of growth? And why has it been a bit difficult now, and if you're looking at current sort of GDP growth in the country, to achieve something similar? I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
You know, as you can imagine, when I assumed the presidency, we met a very difficult situation, like I say, after 2 decades of civil war. The destruction, the deaths of people. Our institutions, you know, no longer function. Our infrastructure was destroyed. Our very economy was down. And so, but I must say that we were very aware of some of these difficulties. We had to prepare for them. We had to have our vision and our agenda to be able to address them. And so we immediately went to work. And one of the things I made a commitment to was that, one, I would try to fight corruption and bring it to an end. Secondly, that I would give more preference to women and youth in the government. I think we succeeded a lot on the latter, not so much on the former, because of the entrenchment of it, that it also became a culture. I think if there were measures we had to take in keeping with our vision and agenda was first to make sure that we restored our fiscal space to be able to raise domestic revenue, because we had only $80 million as the revenue for the country at that time. But to do that, we had to take care of the debt. We had a close to $5 billion external debt on service for years. And so we had to do that. We had to restore the credibility of our country. And that means rebuilding the relationship, bilateral, multilateral, diplomatic relationship with everyone. We also had to have the support of our people. And to get the support of our people meant you have to reach out to them, have to listen to them. You have to make sure that they felt not only hope, but they also felt ownership in whatever we were doing. And so with that, we immediately moved on all of those. We recruited as many of our own compatriots as we could through repatriation programs that were supported by some of our partners. We placed women in what we call the most critical positions, like finance, foreign affairs, trade, commerce and trade, and all of those, to make sure that we know we would get the best results from women. And that's exactly why we put them there. We brought young people into all aspects of our administration. And I think that if we were able to, as we were able, in fact, not if, we were able to reach a very high level of growth during the first years of our administration, the first term of our administration, it was because of a combination of all those. What are some of our lessons? One is listening to others, knowing that there's no monopoly of ideas or talents anywhere. Two, having self-confidence. I mean, you know, that we believe we could do it, that we could make a difference in the countries, and we went about it. But having the capacity, the abilities based on knowledge, based on information, based on thoughts, a combination of all of those. And so I think our result comes from a combination of so many things. And our success also pointed to action on so many areas because of the devastation of the country. There's no way we could do one thing. We had to do everything, be able to get it to the place where we were providing the minimal of service to our people. And over time, I'm glad we're able to expand that to the place where the country had been restored in its reputation, restored in its credibility, restored in hope, you know, restored in progress. And I think it wasn't until we got set back with Ebola, otherwise we would have really, in our second term, we would have done even more. But anyway, we were able to, on the Ebola issue, to be able to fight it and to win it in record time.
Madam President, you just talked about action, the importance of action. One of the things I've sort of encountered in this space, working in sort of the development space, is this idea that, you know, people know what to do and how to do, but the problem seems to be around implementation. Is that something you would agree with, you find true when it comes to, I guess, implementing policy or actually getting things done? Or where do you think the challenge might be?
Very true. Implementation is the hardest part of any action. Part of it is the processes that it takes and the capability that it takes to make things move. Because you have to conform to certain standards, you know, standards of integrity, standards of processes, standards of competition, standards of transparency. So along this long route, you may not get everybody who has a sense of urgency. You may not get everybody who have the requisite capacity to move something as fast. This is why we always talk about bureaucracy, because the bureaucracy is that long line from commitment to cash, from commitment to result, you know, from effort to action. It's because you've got to go through these. But I think every country, as they gain more experience, you know, in civil action, in those who are responsible and have mandate to carry out, that experience sort of contracts the time that they take to do things. But, you know, we always have changes, political changes. New players are introduced into a system, and then you lose a lot of that experience that enables you to have much more efficiency and effectiveness. So this is why my message always is, you know, yes, we need bright talent. Yes, we need new talent. Yes, we need new effort and all of that. But you've got to combine that also with those who have long experience to make sure that implementation moves. And then there are times when it's just, you know, it's just outright somebody who completely disobeys the rules, somebody who's just completely dishonest, you know, and will delay what action needs to be taken because of personal interests. But those are the things that one faces and must constantly monitor progress, constantly ensure that those who have responsibility carry out their responsibility, take action against them when possible, remove them from office if they're not performing, ensure those who violate integrity things are brought to justice. One must just, and this is where a leader comes in, the ability to stay on top of it, to make sure you know what's happening, to ensure that you insist on corrective action when things fall back, and to make sure you take firm decisions, sometimes decisions that make you unpopular.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I can't imagine that it's easy, but it's one of the things, as you're saying, that's what makes a leader, to be able to do those things. Advancing women in public leadership and service is a cause that you've championed and still do. Can you tell me a little bit about why that is and became as important to you personally?
You know, over the years, women have faced major obstacles for advancing in leadership. It's the stereotyping of women. It's the designation of specific roles for women as wives, as mothers, and whatnot. But, you know, times have changed. Today, women are, yes, wives, yes, mothers, and very well doing, carrying out those functions. But women today are able in every way, you know, in capacity, in knowledge, in education, in abilities, in experience. And so it's time that women are recognized for what they are. 50% plus of our population with the requisite capabilities to move things forward. Just think of how a nation would progress so much more if they use all the talents of their nation, not just the men, but to recognize and give women the competition for anything that's there, that they have the knowledge for. And I always say, women are not asking for favors. Women are claiming their rights to be able to compete, their rights to take leadership, their rights to advance. It's time for that. And it's time for the world to recognize how much a better life we would have, because women not only bring whatever is required for effective leadership, but they bring another sensitivity, the sensitivity of respect for human life, respect for human endeavor. Those only come from women because women are women. And have been over time conditioned to respect that, to work for that, and to honor that. And I think that's where I think women leadership brings a certain dimension that just enhances the progress of countries. We just wish that men would see that and see it so that their own wives and their own daughters will rise up and take leadership as much as possible in their own country.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Even hearing that on the other side, I'm like, okay, this is a vote of confidence, even in me as a woman, and to continue to do more. I also wanted to pick your brain a little bit. So in terms of, you know, your years of advocacy, and especially even around getting more women into places of public leadership, are there some key lessons that you would say you have gathered around securing buy-in or getting compromise, especially in sort of the political setting? Because I'm thinking about, usually when you go into a space, there are sort of vested interests that make it difficult to do things. Are there some tools or lessons that you gathered that were very helpful whenever you had to try and get buy-in in terms of your advocacy efforts?
Well, I think to get past some of the obstacles, one need to know them. One need to be bold enough to express them and address them. But one need to also recognize that compromises may be along the way. Reaching out to those who represent the main vanguards of the obstacles to make sure that they understand why it's important to make certain changes and adjustment. Recognizing that not every battle you take, you're going to win. There'll be failures. But when the failures come, you can stop and see failure as the upside down of success, so that you take the lessons of failure and you rebuild and you make another big plunge toward the goal that you want. And that always works for you if you stay focused. Focus on what you want to achieve, remain dedicated, and just moving up. Yes, it's most difficult when women get to the top, You can move sometimes competitively, progressively, until you get to the place where you're going to be the top decision maker. Then all of a sudden, the bridge stops, the roof collapses, you can't go any further. Well, yeah. that's what we have to do. And one of my own vision in the next, call it 5 years, 7 years or so, is that we will see the top leadership as president or prime minister, whatever, in keeping with their system, that we will have at least 5 women. And 5 women in those positions, so they carry the banner. They represent the example. They become the model that we can follow. And so I'm driven by that obsession to see that. And I just pray that I'll have the health and the stamina and the courage to proceed as I am.
I pray so too. That would be amazing, remarkable to see in the world. So yes, I really do hope we get to see that happen. I'm wishing you all the best, of course. One other question I wanted to ask, which I'm sure you may be, you may have had to answer too many times, is Africa's Iron Lady. Where did that come from, and why did you not mind that title when people used it?
You know, this actually came from Margaret Thatcher. You may remember, I always liked the way she took firm decisions in the United Kingdom when she took over. And so she became the Iron Lady. Well, in my travel, my journey, I was a fiscal disciplinarian because, you know, I did finance. Mm-hmm. And so when I started to put some very strict conditions on people who were trying to bypass the rules of being dishonest, I told everybody, I'm going to be the Iron Lady, just like that. I will take those firm, courageous decisions to make sure things are done right. And then, you know, it just grew. And then, of course, the kinds of difficulties I face, you know, coming after the devastation and whatnot, with a lot of people who were warlords who were now Congress people, they were now legislator, they were now holding position. I had to have the strength to also carry out the decision I wanted with them, and to show strength when strength was required, to make firm decision when it was required. And I think, but at the same time, to recognize when it was time to be able to build, build alliances, to build compromises, to build the means of achieving the end one wanted. So you can see that over a lot of times, then the Iron Lady began to achieve a lot of what we wanted to achieve. And As we entered a new phase, I had to reach out to, in a different way, to people. And then recently is now, you know, my Ellen, and that's because as a senior citizen, I have to take different approaches, you know, to reach people.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. So one other question I had for you is, not so much, I guess, this year, but West Africa last year and the year before had a bit of a tumultuous time with coup d'etats. What do you think, from your perspective, it might be trying to tell us about governance that maybe leaders are failing to see or understand?
I don't know whether it's a combination of external intervention led by resources, or whether it's because we have not really institutionalized our political systems and our democracy. They have remained too centralized, too much of the imperial presidency or imperial prime minister. So we haven't yet, I think, develop those institutional systems with the independence to be able to carry on the processes of development even when there's political change. And so we now face a situation where our democracy is threatened because of something that we thought we had passed several decades. We thought we had passed the idea of coup d'etats. Some 30% of our countries in Africa were pursuing full democracy. But now we have to stop. We have to see, you know, what have been the reasons for this backsliding. I think we have not seen sufficient peaceful transfer of power to enable young people to be able to take over so that some of our older heads can step aside and give opportunities to others. And that has now also engendered those feeling that it would move them by force because they want to change. But we need to have a change that's peaceful, that's institutionalized, and that brings the kind of results so that we don't have to limit our nations now facing the difficulties they are.
Madam President, what do you know now about being an African head of state that you wish you had known in, let's say, January 2006? And going from that, I guess, if you had to, I'm sure there are many of them, and you spoke about some of them before, including listening, but what would you say are the top three leadership lessons that you learned as president that you would want, let's say, a young president that came to ask you, what would you tell them?
I think we need, I have found that our African leaders are just too concentrated on power, too concentrated on the perks of power, too much waste of resources on building large facilities and things that, again, are the symbols of power. You know, power doesn't come from amassing public resources or creating other things. Power comes from influence with the people. And I think those countries where you found some of our old leaders, you know, like Nyerere, Nelson Mandela and all, they found their power in influence. They found their power in their ability to motivate and carry their people toward a course they wanted. And so I think I found too much of this influence of power through money, through perks. I guess what I'm saying is, to be a leader, you can be comfortable, but sincere and honest, and learn to live with the people.
Finally, when you think about Africa in the year 2050, what comes to mind? Are you optimistic, pessimistic? What do you envision the continent to look like in 2050?
I hope we would have got past some of the difficulties we face. What are all the many global threats that we face? What are the domestic problems that we face so that Africa finally will get its just support? Africa has always been the one that have been exploited for the development of other areas. And while we must take primary responsibility for our own development, no question about that, but I think the world owes us something. And the world owes us a scale of support that enable us to make that transformation. Not just enough to keep us scrambling and promoting a little at a time, but enough at scale to help us develop those independent institutions, to enable our youth to take over, you know, with a peaceful transfer of power. to get our some of our leaders now to become, like so many of us today, former presidents that remain in eminent service to our continent, giving way for others to take over. But we need that kind of support in our infrastructure to enable us to build bridges among ourselves for our regional cooperation, regional integration. We must also have to enable us to be competitive in the world. It would make a better world if Africa is not always reliant on someone, but using the resources that God has given us to use it well for our own purposes, but giving us the opportunity to move forward and compete through support for our own, for us taking possession in our 2053 African agenda, taking possession of our own future and claiming it, and allowing others to see us for what we are now, brave and comfort, moving under our own direction with our own ownership of what God has rightfully given us.
Madam President, thank you so very much for this time. This has been a remarkable half hour.
Thank you for staying with it and being, you know, a good coordinator on this, asking good questions. So thank you. I look forward to seeing you in October.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.